mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio. This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest today has been on Church and Culture before. Matt Slapp served in the White House for George W. Bush, eventually became political director and deputy assistant to the president, advising the president, the vice president, members of the cabinet, senior White House staff, and members of Congress and federal agencies. He and his wife, Mercy, formed a boutique government public relations firm called Cove Strategies, 2009. I have a feeling that's not so boutique anymore. Matt Slapp, however, now serves as the ninth chairman of the American Conservative Union, which holds the annual CPAC meeting, which is the most important meeting of conservatives, social conservatives, and pro-lifers in the country each year. Matt, welcome back to Church and Culture.
Neil, great to be with you again.
Now, I've asked you to be with me, even though you have to do it from a cell phone. I know you're in between important meetings. We won't name names, but you are, because I want to talk to you as a conservative leader, a Catholic, very devout Catholic. You and Mercy have five beautiful girls, about gun control. On the heels of the Paris shootings, the shootings at the Planned Parenthood Center, which were not aimed at anybody but pro-lifers, and then yesterday's shootings in San Bernardino, the president and his White House staff are calling for much greater gun control legislation. Is there any proof? We'll put aside the Second Amendment issue for a second. But is there any proof that gun control laws or stricter gun control laws lead to less violent or less crime committed with guns?
You know, I in America, which I think is the right first place to make the comparison, you know, it is not just a stereotype to say that the communities that have the strictest gun control measures oftentimes, the largest crime rates go hand in hand with them. So you have Washington, D.C., you have President Obama's hometown of Chicago, Illinois, where homicides are just sadly going through the roof. You have states like California, which was unfortunately the
Well, I did a little research on California.
Yeah.
Compton, California, it ranks 14th for murders. East Palo Alto ranks 20th. San Bernardino ranks 28th. Oakland is right up there. And Oakland is the fifth most dangerous town in the United States. And yet it has the most extensive gun control legislation.
Yeah, I know you didn't want to slip right into politics, but I do think it was interesting that Jerry Brown contrasted with what President Obama said. He did not immediately come out and ask for more gun control because he knows in the state of California they've just got about every variety of gun control you can possibly have. And he realizes that even with that kind of strict gun control, things like this can happen. And we should spend a little time talking about why they can still happen. But So the answer really is not confiscating guns from law-abiding people. It's trying to figure out how we keep guns out of the hands of people that wish to do us harm.
Yeah. In fact, there was an article, Matt, in the Washington Post recently, which had the headline, Zero Correlation Between State Homicide Rate and State Gun Laws. And this comes in the Washington Post, and the writer is from the left, not from the right. Eugene Volkow teaches at UCLA School of Law. And he ran all the numbers, and he found zero correlation. So, I mean, why would president or any other politician presume that more gun legislation will keep guns out of the hands? And let's call them the bad guys. We're not just talking about terrorists. We're talking about criminal. We're talking about thieves. We're talking about gang members. You know, the bad guys, are they going to be affected by gun legislation?
No, of course not. And one of the things we find in so many of these tragedies is we're dealing with perpetrators who actually steal guns or own guns illegally. So, you know, that's the dynamic of how do you pass more gun control when the gun control that's on the books didn't prevent a criminal from grabbing the gun. Do I have to excuse some of the sirens in the background? We have, I think, every Republican presidential candidate in Washington, D.C. today. They're having various meetings. So,
and you just got out of one.
I did. I just got out of one. And the good news is that all of these candidates understand the folly of trying to come up with simplistic answers. But there's another piece to this, which I think is important for your listeners to understand. There's a Democratic dynamic going on here. And the reason why Hillary Clinton, who after all was married to a governor of Arkansas who always tried to appear favorable towards the Second Amendment, Hillary Clinton is saying vociferously at every opportunity that she is going to try to ratchet down on our Second Amendment rights. And there's a political reason for that, not just that there are, you know, the base of the Democratic Party is assiduously liberal. It's also that Bernie Sanders, her rival for the Democratic nomination, has actually had a mixed to semi-decent record on the Second Amendment. And so there's an internal Democratic dynamic going on here.
Well, listen, you kind of dropped my jaw on that. I would have assumed that Bernie Sanders would be totally behind as much gun control legislation, restrictive legislation as possible.
As a candidate for the Democratic nomination, first of all, he's running as a Democrat when he's really more of a socialist, self-avowed. And as a candidate for the Democratic nomination, he is for every kind of gun control you can imagine. But as a member of the House and as the Senate, it's much more mixed. And I think that Clinton campaign sees this as a really, like you said, your jaw drops. People, they want every liberal in this country to know, don't vote for Bernie Sanders. He actually believes in this part of the Constitution.
Well, let's remind our listeners just what the Second Amendment is, and I'll read it since you're driving. I don't want you looking down at your phone. Second Amendment reads this way, that citizens are guaranteed a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, that's capital A, by the way, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, that was a pretty important principle to a young nation who had to, if they hadn't have had arms, they could have not declared their independence and there would be no United States. You think that's a fair assumption?
Yeah, because you look at the totalitarian states in recent memory, the Nazis, the Castros, you go down the line, one of the very first steps those autocrats take is to confiscate everyone's guns because that's a threat to the ruling regime.
And it, you know, we think in the United States that it can't happen here. You know, that it would never go, come down to a situation where we were actually defending our families, your and mine, with handguns, my father's grandfather's shotgun and .22 rifle. The wonderful handgun I won for winning the Marine Corps golf tournament at Fort Belvoir, which I've never even taken out of the box. It's a Glock. I've never even taken it out of the box. Now I'm beginning to think I got to get that Glock out of the box and learn how to use it.
But you do. You do need to learn how to use it because there's a couple of reasons why. Most of the gun experts I know, it's pretty serious responsibility when you own a weapon, and you need to learn how to use it. And I have to say, I'm sad to say, I think the chances that you may have to use it to protect your family are growing, not shrinking.
Well, I think that seems to me to be the only conclusion that you can come away with. And I've known a lot of people who their entire lives have kept licensed handguns in their cars at all times, loaded guns somewhere in their homes, hopefully, well hidden from the kids their entire lifetimes. When I was 10 or 11, one of the first things my dad showed me how to do, a veteran of World War II, he grew up on a ranch in Texas, is how to handle and fire a firearm. So it's not like I am in any way afraid of guns. I have just, I guess, being born in 1949, Matt, I just never thought it would come to this, that you would actually think that some moment will arrive in Fairfax, Virginia, or some other place where I happen to be or my family is, where I need to pull out a gun and defend myself.
Well, I have, you mentioned I'm the father of five young daughters between the ages of 3 and 12. I grew up kind of all over the country, but eventually became a Kansan, but did not grow up in a rural setting. I grew up in an urban setting. And, the concept of owning guns was very foreign to my parents.
And Kansas? I thought everybody had gun in Kansas.
Well, my parents were New Yorkers, right? And they were city people. And the people who have guns in big cities like that are usually the bad people. And, I tell you, I have a totally different mentality, and I'm teaching each of my girls. I don't do it because I don't think I have the knowledge, but I have friends who do. We're teaching them gun safety. We're teaching them not to be afraid, but we're teaching them to be respectful of the object. And, here's the bottom line, and every policeman will tell you, if something happens, by the time the police can usually get there, a bad person would have already perpetrated on you or your family before the first responders can get there. The second thing you need to remember, Deal, is every speech where Hillary Clinton stands up and says she wants gun control, she is driven to that speech by people who are all carrying weapons. While she is giving this speech, she has people standing around her who all have weapons. Pretty easy for Hillary Clinton to say that we ought to have gun control.
Yeah, and you knew that because you worked in the White House for 8 years.
That's right. That's right.
Matt, I want to remind people that you're the chairman, the ninth chairman of the American Conservative Union. CPAC is coming up. What are the dates for this year's CPAC?
March 2nd through 5th, so right after the beginning of the year, and right after the Super Tuesday primary, the first Tuesday of March, we will assemble at the National Harbor just south of the Ronald Reagan Airport, which is apropos. And I believe that we will get every presidential candidate there. We'll have every major conservative leader. And I will tell you, Deal, our enrollment is already going at double the pace of last year. I think it's going to be a great event.
And, by the way, I want to just say that I've been to many CPACs. It's a wonderful event. It's really my favorite conservative/social conservative event in D.C., and National Harbor is a wonderful facility, except my next-door neighbor runs the place. But it's a wonderful facility, and it's very easy to get to from the airport, extremely easy, and from the train station, for that matter. Where would listeners go to learn more about CPAC and perhaps sign up to be here that first weekend in March?
So CPAC is run by the American Conservative Union, as you said. So you can go to our website, at conservative.org, or you can go to cpac.org. It's the same organization, and get all the information. There are some discounts for seniors and for veterans, which is appropriate. And you can get all the information about hotel rooms and everything else. But now your listeners have learned they just need to call you because you have the access to their
the next-door neighbor is the general manager of the place.
You might be sorry you said that deal.
I know. Well, I'll be very happy to help anybody get to CPAC who wants to go.
I want everybody to call us, and if you feel like you don't have the money, call us anyway. You need to call
right.
Us.
Oh, really? Okay. That's a great offer, and I know you're good for it. Matt, as I said, I'd be glad to help anyone get to CPAC who wants to get there, and I hope many will. And I'm sure you're going to have a perhaps the highest number of attendees ever. Do you think gun control will now become an issue in the upcoming presidential election?
I do. I think it's an issue that the Democrats are going to stay on. You know, the Democrats have been convinced that guns were a losing issue for them, and that has changed. I think they now feel like talking about guns is a winning issue for them.
Do you think they're right?
I don't think they're right. But here's one thing I do know. Barack Obama won the presidency and was reelected on the premise that what he had to do is continue to grow his liberal base. And Hillary Clinton is going to run by that same playbook. So they're going to run left, and that's going to mean a lot of talk about banning guns and grabbing guns. And I think this country is still very strongly constitutional and believes in the Second Amendment, and I hope we can push back on this.
Well, I did some research, actually, to get ready to talk to you because, frankly, I didn't know much about it. Let me begin by throwing this out to you, that it seems as if the one issue that Obama has in mind is the ability of people to go to gun shows and buy guns on the spot without getting licenses from the state. The distinction being they're not buying them to use to hunt or to, shoot targets, but they're collectors. And he wants to cut off the ability of people to buy guns at gun shows in that way. What do you think of that?
That's one way to say it. Another way to say it is that, you know, deal, if you wanted to sell me that Glock you won in your golf tournament, because you know my golf's so bad I'll never win anything, including a Glock, if you want to sell me that gun at some kind of fair market rate, that we really can't do that without going through the government and having the government do a background check on me and then, having the government say that sale is okay. And I think there are many constitutional scholars who would say that really is impeding too much on this concept of being able to own guns. Because what if you wanted to even give it to me gratis or just say, hey, give me $10? There's a balance here. Not everybody should have to be a federally licensed firearms dealer to pass guns down generationally, which is part of the American experience for a lot of especially people who grew up in rural America. So, you know, I think what Obama is trying to say and what Democrats have tried to say and what people like John McCain have tried to say is that the real problem is that we have these loopholes in our background check system. But that's really not what the loophole is. What the loophole is in our background system is that, and I think we all know this, is that the government is sitting on all kinds of files and documents and information that actually don't get put in the system. If every time they audit the national background check system, they find that records are not being put in rapidly enough. They find that there are all kinds of files and documents that haven't been appended to the files. And so if we want to get serious about, you know, closing loopholes, let's get serious about actually having a background check system that is as near foolproof as we can get. And I think we ought to give all of the resources possible to it. And I also think it's fair in this country to have a conversation about, whether someone's got the mental capacity to have a gun.
And And let me ask you this question. I know you're not an expert in criminology, but how many of these individuals who murder people, whether they're just crooks, criminals, thugs, gang members, or terrorists, how many of these people do you think are buying their guns at gun shows?
Oh, I think a very small percent. Matter of fact, most of the crimes that are committed with guns, with firearms, are committed with firearms that they don't really lawfully own. So that's a huge driver to the problem. I mean, if you're a crook or a criminal and you're going to steal things, why would you start off by buying your weapon appropriately?
You don't want your weapon to be traceable, do you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you might not pass a background check because of your criminal background. So that's one of the reasons why liberals love this idea of gun buybacks and why they like this idea of making it harder for you to buy weapons, including putting limits on how many guns you can buy a year, because they have this kind of utopian idea that if guns are turned into plowshares and we smelt guns down and we have gun buyback programs and turn guns into art in the city square, that in and of itself, if you reduce the population of guns, that will somehow make it safer. And I just, there are some estimates that we have 2 billion guns in America. It is such a shallow and silly way to look at it.
Now, you're a devout Catholic, and I mentioned that you'd gone to Notre Dame, and I'm proud of it. As a Catholic, does this make you nervous, talking about resisting gun control, talking about, like you advised me earlier, to get the Glock out from wherever it is and learn how to use it? Does that in any way tinge your Catholic conscience?
No, my Lord, not at all. I think I have a responsibility as a father. My kids have a responsibility to respect me, but I got a responsibility to protect them. I often tell my wife our job as parents is not to run their lives, but to use a baseball analogy, it's to help them put the ball on the tee. And then they get to swing away, and if I don't do what I can to create a safe environment for them, I think I'm reneging on my responsibilities. And let me tell you something else as Catholics. We're not just inspirational people. We're people that understand policy, and we're people that understand doctrine, and we're people that understand that you've got to have laws to govern a civil society. And our Constitution is the best example of any written document for free people to govern themselves in the history of mankind. And the Second Amendment, number two, is about the right to keep and bear arms, because they understood that if the people didn't feel like they could protect themselves, even from government when needed, that democracy would be at risk. And I think that's a concept we should all embrace.
And after all, if you apply Catholic just war theory to a situation where you have somebody trying to kill you or your family, you're absolutely justified in defending yourself and killing that person if necessary.
Absolutely. And some of our laws are not as clear as the just war theory, because there are some states that make it actually hard for you to defend your family. But let's go back to the Constitution for a minute. I'm okay with liberals saying they want to have gun control. My beef with them is they're dishonest in how they want to get it done. In other words, when you have a Constitution that calls for the way in which those words can be amended, that's the process to follow. If they want to change the Bill of Rights and change the Second Amendment, they have to go back and change the words in the Constitution by the process prescribed in the document. Now, why don't we just hold them to that? Every time they want gun control, why don't we simply say, go for it. Start the constitutional amendment process. It's what conservatives do when they want to change the Constitution. Democrats, of course, just run to the judges they appointed to the court in the previous decade and get it done the fast way.
Well, there's a story out today that President Obama is looking at what kind of executive order he could issue that would get this job done. What do you think that would amount to?
Well, I mean, I have to think this through because he's contorted my brain into a pretzel when it comes to what the power of the
president. Right. I mean, now it seems like anything is possible at this point.
Yeah, and now what he's saying is whether it's global climate change legislation, whether it's, language on contraception, he's now telling us he not only has the ability to go around Congress and pass legislation, he believes that he can have some permanence to these executive orders. And, Bill, you know this because, we dealt on the march to public policy many times, but if a president decides to act unilaterally, one of the trade-offs in our constitutional system is, number one, it has to be legal, but number two, you don't get the permanence of law. You get the permanence of your time in office.
Yeah, the next guy that comes in can just flip it over.
Right, and that's what's happened with the Mexico City.
Yes.
The Republicans have come in and installed it, and Democrats have come in and ripped it out, and that is our legal framework. And Obama is trying to set it up through the courts so that many of these executive orders that he's thrust on us will have some permanency. And if that were to happen, I think our separation of powers would really cease to resemble what the founders wanted.
Matt Schlapp, have you ever heard of the two ways of reading the Second Amendment, the individual right theory and the collective rights theory? Have you ever heard of this?
Yeah. Yes, and that was a matter of some controversy in the first term of the Bush administration because General Ashcroft viewed and made it clear that the government's position was that this was an individual right, whereas the collectivists among us believe that the Second Amendment was put in the Constitution so to make clear that it was okay for the government to have something akin to a police force.
Yeah, because what they're trying to do is elide the first part of the amendment with the second. That is, say, connect a well-regulated militia and then subsume the right of the people to keep and bear arms under the idea of a militia.
Yes, that's right. And here's the part that is so maddening. Whenever you have one of these shootings and one of these terrible tragedies, which has happened literally hundreds and hundreds of times in our history, somebody eventually takes the shooter out in most cases, unless the shooter turns the gun on him or herself. And oftentimes that person who takes them out is a civilian. Okay. That civilian is operating in a way to protect the people in their community.
I'm talking with Matt Schlapp, head of the American Conservative Union, about to put on a CPAC event, another one, in March here in Washington, D.C. After this short break, we'll be back to talk more with Matt Schlapp about gun control.
Light of the East. Weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, whether he is Santa Claus or St. Nicholas, the liturgical celebration of the Feast of St. Nicholas is a witness to how Eastern churches evangelize and live in the both and.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
Pope Francis has announced a year of mercy beginning this December 8th, and Archbishop Alan Vigneron has announced a year of evangelization for the Archdiocese of Detroit. St. Malachy Catholic Church will be participating in both these spiritual events by offering 24 hours of Eucharistic devotion and 24 hours of the Sacrament of Reconciliation. St. Malachy is located on 14 Mile Road in Sterling Heights between Shaner and Hayes. Call us at 586-264-1220 or email at contact@stmalachychurch.org.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
What does it take to create a truly joyful family life? It might be easier than you think. Researchers at the University of Illinois found that families who made regular time for simple things like family dinners, a game night, family days, family prayer, and even working together on household chores were much happier and more stable than families that spent their time on other activities in their community and school. In fact, the families that made time for these simple rituals were less likely to have kids with school or emotional problems, or deal with promiscuity or drug and alcohol issues, and the parents had happier marriages and greater life satisfaction to boot. If you want to experience your family life as a gift, take time unwrapping that gift by investing in those simple activities of family life that enable you to get to know one another and stay connected to one another. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
I'm back with Matt Schlapp, who is the chairman of the American Conservative Union. He's about to put on the 2016 CPAC meeting in Washington in early March. You can go to the American Conservative Union website to see how to attend that meeting, what's going on at that meeting. Matt, I wanted to just sort of read out loud to you the five states that have the most stringent gun control legislation and just get your reaction. California, Hawaii, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York, and Washington, D.C. What does that list say to you?
Bastions of liberal policy in combination with serious crime problems.
Except in Hawaii.
Yeah, well, everyone's a little more chill out there.
It seems to be the one state where either the laws are working or they didn't need them in the first place.
That's right. The kind of laws they're breaking in Hawaii are not the ones that we call homicides.
No, you don't exactly use a gun to steal a surfboard, but we all know that Washington, D.C., New York, New Jersey, in fact, New Jersey has the number one most dangerous city in the United States, which is Camden, New Jersey, and the 10th most, which is Newark, and the 8th most, which is Atlantic City, of all places, a tourist town. Once again, as we spoke at the very beginning of our conversation, and as we saw in a recent Washington Post article, there doesn't seem to be any correlation between more stringent gun laws and crime with handguns. And when we looked at the specific kind of legislation that President Obama wants to pass, that is closing this loophole about buying guns at gun shows, we went over the fact that it's gun shows are not the place where criminals and terrorists buy their guns. So what would that accomplish? Matt Schlapp, you said you were not opposed to gun control. Tell us what kind of gun control you would support.
Well, I actually think I am philosophically opposed to the concept of gun control. I don't think it really accomplishes anything. What I'm okay with is honest liberals or gun control advocates doing it the right way, which is the constitutional way. It's the view I had on all these kinds of major questions of marriage. It's been the Constitution. We're in a democracy. I'm okay with people taking on the democratic system and trying to convince the majority of people that their way is right. When it comes to guns, I think there are regimes that can be set up. We've set up an instant background check. I think it passes the constitutional muster of not infringing our rights. It's still taking kind of common sense steps to make sure that the guns don't end up in the wrong hands. I also think as a country, we could benefit very much from the concept of looking at this whole question of those folks who are emotionally unstable. And I think there's a lot of good conservatives and constitutionalists who agree with that.
Absolutely.
We have to do it within our Constitution.
It's common sense.
Common sense. Right.
I think that, when you get Hillary Clinton on the stump yesterday, after news of the San Bernardino shooting started to break, saying we have to stand up to the NRA, trying to demonize the NRA. I mean, President Obama says stop demonizing Planned Parenthood, right?
Right.
And here you have the next day Hillary Clinton, trying to demonize the NRA, which is, and correct me if I'm wrong, the most bipartisan lobby in Washington.
Yes, absolutely. And a very important person in my life, my wife, is on its board. And the fact is that the NRA is one of the oldest organizations in our democracy in terms of public advocacy, and was created in order to help veterans and help explain gun safety to people. So, I mean, this is like woven into our American experience. And once again, it's completely 100% all about supporting our Constitution. And we get a lot of that kind of talk from people that try to advocate for organizations like Planned Parenthood, and they ought to be consistent. If they think, you know, I don't agree with them, that there's a right to privacy in the Constitution that somehow is in there, even though the words aren't there, they ought to at least agree with the words that are in there. Clearly.
Have you used that line before? That's really good.
I haven't. You know, when I'm in traffic, deal, just things start coming out of my brain.
Yeah, that we need to jot that down. We discussed earlier that the Democrats were beginning to see gun control as possibly a issue that benefits them, but doesn't the gun control issue really come down to a state by state kind of evaluation? I mean, for example, Michigan is going to be different from New Hampshire, or maybe not. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, this is to go back to the question of Bernie Sanders. Why does Bernie Sanders have a decent, not perfect, not great, but decent Second Amendment voting record, particularly when he was in the House? He's from Vermont. You know the culture of Vermont. Vermont is a colder version of some areas.
Freedom. Freedom.
That's right. It's about freedom, and it's also about a way of life. And some people actually use their guns to kill their food and eat. And it's part of the culture. And there's no question of all those states that you read off, at least kind of the northeastern corridor states. You know, I look at those states and I look at their horrendous crime problems, and it just can't help me think that isn't it so typical of so many liberals to think that guns are the problem? I look at those statistics and say, I bet it's our families that are the problem.
Yeah, I mean, the absence of fathers, the breakdown of communities, especially in the inner city. I mean, as I looked through the list of the 100 most dangerous cities in the United States, I was surprised to see the names of cities that I, like East Palo Alto, I mean, that's where Stanford is. I saw in, for example, in Massachusetts, New Bedford, beautiful little town, Springfield, Fall River, Holyoke, great college there, Lawrence, Worcester. These are all among the 100 most dangerous cities in the United States. In New York State, you have Poughkeepsie, Newburgh, Buffalo, Niagara Falls, 44th most dangerous city in the country. These are communities that I've been through. I've been there, and I don't, with the exception of a few, I've never thought of them as dangerous at all. What's happened?
Yeah, what's happened is we have a serious culture. We have serious cultural problems in this society, and we have to stop looking at the easy things, the things that help us to score political points, and we have to go deeper. We have to look at our communities. We have to look at the secularization of the society. We have to look at the fact that many people feel desperate. People feel isolated. And we've got to change this dynamic. We've got to change this course we're on. It is not good for our country to become more secular. It's not good for our country and our citizens to feel like they don't have a higher purpose to their life. And it's not a positive thing that violence seems to be growing, and I'm incredibly concerned about it. I think all honest liberals know that gun control in the end doesn't do a dang thing to change these dynamics. The fact is that the solutions that many big government people have had have not worked, and they just can't publicly get themselves to admit it.
You know, Matt, you recall that right after Bush left office, I published a book on politics called Onward Christian Soldiers, where I tracked the history of evangelical and Catholic participation in politics. And the one most sort of fundamental principle that I discovered was this, that there will continue to be a strong influence on American politics by the people of faith as long as people attend church regularly. And we're talking about both evangelicals and Catholics. There was an article today in the paper that in the American South, I mean the hotbed of evangelicalism, in Alabama, you know, there was a city there near Birmingham that suddenly voted to allow alcohol to be sold on Sunday. I mean, symbolically, this was, you know, a breaking of the hold of conservative Christians over that community. And I think there is a trend nationally, fewer people are going to church. And I think that what we would call kind of earnest Christianity, and this is true, even the Southern Baptist Convention is having a crisis, earnest Orthodox Christianity is not in the ascendancy at all. It's either flatlining or on the decline.
Yeah, no question about it. And, of course, as Catholics, we're having our own conversation about what we're hearing from the Pope and what, you know, what is this all about, and what does it mean to be a Catholic in terms of your political stances. You know, this is a very open conversation, and I think the reason why Catholics are having this conversation and evangelicals are having this conversation is because they are seeing their flocks and they're seeing their communities become more secular. And they're seeing them drift, and they're seeing them uncatechized. And I think the message has been watered down if for no other reason. People have moved so much further away from the truth that the church holds dear. So, you know, I think this is a trend that's the most troubling trend in the country.
And as you said earlier, it's the answer to the problem. It's the answer to the cultural problem, communal, familial, individual. But yet what we're seeing is a turning away from the centrality of faith, the centrality of worship. We're not seeing people embracing the solution. They're only really, frankly, it's the solution that was the foundation of this nation. It was the foundation of what America is, its basic rights, its basic vision of life, its basic vision of itself as a nation. In other words, that vision is diminishing as people stop practicing their faith, to put it bluntly.
Well, you know, what's very clear from the founders is that they did not believe that the American democratic experience would last long if it was divorced from faith. And George Washington was more specific. He said it can't exist separated from religion. So our founders were very clear on this, that this was a hand-in-hand experience. And because in a democracy, it's about the people. And if the people stray from understanding the fundamental truths of life, then the government will be downstream of that. And, you know, but I have great hope. I really do feel, I know you do too, which is there's a plan. God's got a plan. Got a plan for each one of us. I believe he's got a plan for America. And I believe that America has had moments where it has experimented with the idea of secularism. And we've had also great moments when the people have turned back to God. And
various great awakenings, we call them.
I was going to use that term. I think that's exactly right. And I just think with everything that's going on in the globe, with all the persecution of Christians around the globe, it's time for America to recapture that spirit, the spirit.
What do you make of the fact that Christianity in particular has become the butt of so many jokes in the world of entertainment, but also in the world of journalism. You know, we used to talk about the only acceptable prejudice was to be anti-Catholic. Now it seems that the acceptable prejudice is to be anti-Christian. Or do you think I'm exaggerating?
No, I don't think you're exaggerating, and I think there's a great hostility towards people of faith and towards Christians in general. I think that it's kind of the one thing, you know, I'll admit that I have kind of a wide-ranging sense of humor. I'm irreverent. I have a Midwestern flatness to me. But I tell you, when people make fun of God, I cringe because I know it is just horribly irreverent and it's sinful. And it's just, you're right, it's just so accepted in society. Even shows you like to watch, they go there. And political shows that I appear on go there. And it's not appropriate, it's not acceptable. And I don't think God...
Well, they especially go there in the green room when you're in your private conversations with the people from the left.
You know, I've gotten to just about the age, I'm 47, where there's something very freeing about the fact that when I'm in those green rooms, I don't feel so much stress to reveal who I really am. And
right.
there's a great freedom in that. But when you're a younger man and you're trying to make your career,
right.
I will tell you, if you're in the corporate world, I feel sorry for these people. If you're a manager in a publicly held corporation, if you are too Christian, too devout, you're a dead man or woman walking.
It becomes very, very difficult because it raises all the concerns that corporations have about issues of equality, of women's issues, racial issues, the feminist influence in corporations. They don't want those what they consider divisive people. Especially in management positions.
Yeah, no, that there's no question. I can't tell you how horrible it is what is happening in corporations across this country. What happened to managers? Basically, if you're going to be a manager of people, you have to be devoid of faith or any public demonstration of it.
Because, well, you have to have had sensitivity training.
That's right.
I mean, I'm comparing what you're saying with what's going on in the academic world right now with this thing called microaggressions. I mean, I taught philosophy, as you know, for 15 years, and I probably never taught a class that didn't have a handful of microaggressions.
Yes, that's right.
You know, when you tell a student they're wrong, I guess that's a microaggression. Or when you say, why didn't you turn in your homework? Or, you know, why did you fall asleep? Or why didn't you bring your book to class? I mean, those are all microaggressions of some sort.
I don't know if you realize this. I know you have children, Deal, but, you know, everyone gets a trophy now. I think you've just not realized that we've had a change in our society. You know, you won the Glock in the golf tournament. Now everybody wins the Glock.
Boy, I've never seen so many golfers angry at me in my life. I mean, they were visibly upset that I, the non-Marine in the crowd, you know, who never even served in the armed forces, was walking out of there with a Glock. I guess I can't really blame them.
For certain traditionalists, Glock is not the handgun of choice because it is made mostly from plastic parts. You know, it doesn't have beautiful wooden handles and all the metal work. So,
or people, the purists like what, Smith & Wesson, or what are they like?
Yeah, they have, there are all kinds of brands. SIG is one and others that they prefer. But the...
I guess on Church and Culture, we shouldn't be recommending to our listeners certain brands of handguns. That's probably not what we should be doing.
Like we said earlier, everything for its right purpose.
Well, what we do want to say to our listeners, though, is that when you hear the call for more restrictions, more gun control legislation, realize that the relationship between these laws in states like California, New York, and Massachusetts and New Jersey just haven't produced safer environments. It just hasn't worked.
And the other story deal that does not get all of the media coverage, like this horrible tragedy in San Bernardino, the most recent tragedy, is receiving, and it should receive. But what doesn't get covered as much is the millions of examples where the proper ownership and use of a handgun saves somebody's life, prevents a terrible crime from being committed.
Well, I wonder if anybody's kept the statistics on that.
Yes, and I'm going to send it to you, and I'm not usually ready with the figures, but
okay. Well, with Mercy, your wife, being on the board of the NRA, I suppose you have access to files like
it's
this,
huge,
right?
It's a huge annual.
I probably got the wrong member of the family on the phone right now. Actually,
let me tell you, she's better on every topic, and she's definitely better. On
No, she's just better looking, not necessarily
and she's also
better.
She's better at more languages, too, so she kind of beats me on everything.
Oh, I love it. Well, it's great to have you back on Church and Culture. Once again, I've been talking to Matt Schlapp, friend now for a very long time, and Mercy. I knew them before they got married, even, in the Bush White House. And thanks for being a guest again on Church and Culture. Let's say once again to our listeners how they can learn about CPAC.
Yeah, please come to CPAC right after Super Tuesday, March 2nd through 5th in 2016, at a very critical point in the presidential nominating process. And we want to be good hosts, and we want you to learn, and we want to really get our country on the right track.
Okay, and that's coming from Matt Schlapp, who's chairman of the American Conservative Union that hosts CPAC every year. Matt, once again, thanks for being a guest on Church and Culture.
Thanks, Teal.
Matt Schlapp had to leave. He was scheduled very tightly today. I greatly appreciate him getting on the show for as long as he did. But this discussion of gun control is something that I want to outline with you again so that you can have some kind of coherent, hopefully, overview of the discussion that we just had. I want to begin with the fact that when you hear about Second Amendment issues, we're talking about what is in our Constitution and has been in our Constitution from the very beginning, which says that we, the citizens of the United States, will have a right to a well-regulated militia, which is being necessary to the security of a free state, and the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. There's two things, in other words. The right to a military to protect the state, to keep its security, and the right of individual people to keep and bear arms. Now, there have been two Supreme Court interpretations of the Second Amendment. One is the individual right theory, other is the collective rights theory. The individual rights theory states that this amendment pertains to individuals' rights to keep and bear arms. And surprisingly enough, that is not the interpretation that the Supreme Court put forth in its 1939 decision called United States versus Miller. They actually proposed the collective rights theory, which put the right to bear arms of individuals under the well-regulated militia. In other words, you could own a gun if you were part of the state's military establishment. But in 2008, in a Supreme Court decision called District of Columbia versus Heller, the individual rights theory was reasserted, and it was reasserted once again in a 2010 decision, and both of these Supreme Court cases had to do with individuals or cities which were challenged regarding very, very strict gun control. And so in each case, the court decided in favor of the individual rights theory. That's kind of a summary of where we are in gun control, the Second Amendment. And thank you very much for being with me today on Church and Culture. And if you'll wait, we'll have another great guest in just a moment.
Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life. The document created to guide the discussions at the October 2015 Worldwide Synod of Bishops in Rome states the following, quote, "Life is a gift of God and a transcendent mystery. Consequently, in no manner must persons at the beginning of life or its end be discarded. On the contrary, steps ought to be taken to ensure that these stages of human life receive special attention." End quote. Here the Synod applies an approach we see in the life of Jesus. He went first to the weakest and poorest, and paid the most attention to those who needed the most help. It is also a common sense approach. The weakest must be defended first. Let's give more attention to the children in the womb and to those who are weakened by age and sickness.
This is Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. All interested are invited to a free program entitled Relapse Prevention, Tuesday, December 15th at St. Joseph Hospital's Education Center in Ypsilanti. Dawn Farm therapist Eric Anderson will discuss how to identify and prevent addiction relapses. Registration is not required, but for more information, call 734-485-8725 or visit dawnfarm.org. If you'd like to publicize your upcoming event on the community calendar, you can enter it yourself at avemariaradio.net. Click on Community and then Community Calendar and then fill out the fields for your event. Your event will appear on the internet calendar within a couple of days. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077. Catholic Radio is yours to keep.
Are you tired of the way your faith is represented in the mainstream media? Stop getting your Catholic news from secular sources and get it from a trusted local Catholic source instead. At the Michigan Catholic Newspaper, we're Catholic, and we cover your Catholic Church in a way that only Catholics could. For the same reason you listen to Ave Maria, get the Michigan Catholic for just $24 a year by calling 313-224-8000 or visit themichigancatholic.com.
Is your student dyslexic? Then she may have talents and abilities you don't know about. Today on Homeschool Heartbeat, join HSLDA special needs consultant Faith Behrens to learn how you can teach to your dyslexic child's strengths.
One of HSLDA's special needs consultants, Faith Behrens, is with us again today. Faith, do you find that children who have dyslexia often have compensating strengths in other areas?
Absolutely. We all have strengths and weaknesses. Keep in mind there are different types of dyslexia or root causes for these specific reading disabilities. But in general, dyslexic people are very bright, creative, or artistic. They're observant. They think in pictures. They're often mechanical, athletic, or musical. Many are very strong auditory learners, good at remembering what they hear. Others have a really strong photographic memory. So it's important for parents to recognize their children's strengths and teach to those strengths. Play them up. My good friend Diane Kraft always encourages parents to help children tap into their